That's kind of conversation between the soul. That's conversation between the soul and the night.
Hello, Prestige Heads, and welcome to American Prestige. I'm Danny Bessner, here as always with my friend and comrade, Derek Davison. And I personally, and I'm sure Derek is as well, extremely excited to welcome to the podcast today, Michael Stuhlbarg. Michael, you almost all certainly know him. He's an actor, and his credits include A Serious Man, Call Me By Your Name, The Shape of Water, Boardwalk Empire, and he's now starring as Boris Berezovsky in Patriots on Broadway. And I had the pleasure of reading the play. It's really, really excellent. So for anyone interested, the last generation or two of Russian political, economic history, cultural history, I strongly recommend you check it out. And Michael, thank you so much for joining us.
Absolutely. My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Danny, so, I just want to say I am excited, but don't ever speak for me again.
I'm sorry. Very, very difficult, Michael, as you've seen. Jay, cut it out. Michael, before we get into Patriots, which of course we're going to talk about, one thing that I would like to ask is, I'm a professional historian, and obviously one of the things that historians do when they write their books is they try to get into the minds of their historical subjects. I wrote a biography of a guy named Hans Speyer. And, you know, I spent years in his head, years in his mind, trying to figure out how he moves through the world. And even though I'm no actor, I understand that there's something similar at what actors do with really any character. But it does seem to me that there might be an added complication with portraying someone historically, because it's not only getting into the universal human experience, but putting them in their direct historical context. So I would love to ask you, as someone who's played so many historical figures, how do you approach that problem as an actor trying to inhabit a character?
Every opportunity I've been given has been different, as you can imagine. Some of the people whom I've had the opportunity to play, there's a lot written about, and some of them there aren't. With Arnold Rothstein in Boardwalk Empire, there was a fantastically dense and wonderfully nuanced biography about him that I started with and then gathered as much literature as I can. And with other people like Paul Marshall, who I played in Pawn Sacrifice, which was about Bobby Fischer and the 1972 chess championship. I just had to dig around online and actually ended up meeting people who knew him. And then, by great good fortune, was able to connect with his widow, Betty. And she couldn't have been kinder about sharing as much information about him and telling me the, you know, peccadilloes about his behavior, his view of life. So each one is different. I generally just start just like I imagine you do as well, which is by gathering as much information as you can. To me, the more you know, it makes your job not just easier, but you can see where an author in the text may choose to deviate from what the truth may have been in order to perhaps just move the action forward, or for whatever reason they may choose not to include everything. So I like to know when something is not being included, and perhaps even offer some information up historically if it might be valuable to include in the story. So it's really just a detective predicament. You dig as much as you can with as much time as you have. Sometimes you're not given a lot of time either, so you kind of have to run with it. In the case of Patriots, the play was presented to me a few years ago, but I was unfortunately unavailable to participate in it when it was done at the Almeida. For some reason, they believed that I was in many ways the right person to play this role, and I was grateful to be thought on, but I couldn't participate. And now, when this came back to me they were juggling whether or not there would be a theater available to put it on in. And if so, if it could be done in the spring or if it could be done in the fall. So I didn't know if and when it was going to happen. So I wasn't digging into it and wasn't doing research. And then finally, things happened very quickly. And then I had to absorb as much as I could very quickly. So it's been a race to get it on in the time that we've had.
One of the things that I'm curious with is with a performance like this, a play like this that is obviously contemporarily very resonant given what's happening in Ukraine, and you know, just the position that Vladimir Putin occupies in the consciousness. I imagine there was you all went to some effort not to sort of devolve into cliches, having Putin, you know, as the kind of mustache twirling bad guy and portraying Berezovsky, who's a complicated figure, comes up in the 90s, which is, you know, makes his fortune in the 90s, which in Russia means there were some not so savory things going on there. But not to portray him just as sort of the heroic figure who breaks with Putin. And how did you approach that problem of kind of, you know, this trying to do a nuanced performance about a subject and you know, really Putin in particular, who does not allow for a lot of nuance in sort of the public consciousness and Berezovsky as well, obviously.
It's fascinating to me to dig into the history a little bit and to look at the trajectory of how these men met and how they got to know each other, which was at the beginning of the 90s. And they'd be when Putin was the deputy mayor of St. Petersburg. For those people who are listening to this and don't know this story at all, basically Boris Berezovsky, at least in terms of our story, was a science and mathematician, a genius, who had a thriving, fascinating career in science and math, was one of the rare people who had been accepted into the Academy of Sciences, one of 800 people out of the entire, you know, millions of people in the Soviet Union. He was a unique individual and very, very bright, who did his research on a decision-making theory, which is fascinating in and of itself. And then when perestroika happened, he took his wherewithal and basically, under the crazy circumstances of communism falling and trying to evolve into a democracy, he leapt into what was a crazy Wild West free market situation and made a huge amount of money really, really quickly. Our story takes you and guides you through the trajectory of these men meeting when Putin was somewhat of a non-entity and he was working for the mayor of St. Petersburg, Sobchak, and is kind of an innocuous presence. Who we learn had been a member of the KGB for 16 years. And it's a slow progression of people under this strange and turbulent time, you know, doing favors for each other. You know, Berezovsky wanted to open a dealership in St. Petersburg, and Putin helped him out. Putin also, apparently, according to Berezovsky, was one of the only bureaucrats who didn't ask for money in exchange for doing a kindness for him. So they got to know each other in a very affable, easygoing way and became friendly. Berezovsky says they weren't necessarily friends, but they did go places together and their families knew each other and those kinds of things. He says they weren't close friends, but they knew each other. So because of all the interesting history there is between these individuals and watching their trajectories and watching where they go and how their lives grew and the crazy things that happen to them with Putin, he becomes next, he gets fired after the election. Sobchak loses the election. Putin chooses not to although he's asked to help the adversary of Sobchak to work for their administration as mayor, the new mayor of St. Petersburg. He chooses not to, remains loyal to Sobchak, so he becomes a taxi driver. So for a while, he's driving a taxi around St. Petersburg. And for Boris, he meets Roman Abramovich, someone who he didn't know, a young man on a boat somewhere. We set up their meeting in a different way in the play for dramatic license and for probably a little bit more ease. But he meets Abramovich, and the two of them create a company together that makes them both wealthy beyond their wildest dreams. So Boris becomes a billionaire. And then these kind of ping pong events happen throughout the course of things. And so it, to me, it's fascinating. And there's not much of a chance of the portrayals necessarily going awry. You're simply playing the circumstances of them getting to know each other. Boris, when he's at the top of his game, and Vladimir Putin, when he's at the bottom of his game. And then the sort of, you get to see the scales kind of equal out for a while and then kind of go in a skyrocket fashion for Putin, whereas Boris's direction goes in another way.
So really diving into this period, even in the short amount of time, as someone who sort of lived through it from the other side, was there anything that was revealed to you? Obviously, the title could be read both seriously and ironically, and I think that's sure. One of the fun things of the play itself is that it plays with both. But delving into this period, as you know, someone who was alive during the 1990s, as we all were, and sort of seeing what was happening to Russia, how did that reveal character to you, or did it reveal something about the period that you might have otherwise not known, just looking on from it from America?
I'm sorry, I don't quite understand the question. Forgive me. How did having lived through the? I'm sorry. Could you?
No worries. Just so, as someone who was watching what was happening to Russia in the 1990s from the American side, this moment of extreme Cold War triumphalism, this moment that capitalism has defeated communism, just a moment of serious triumph. I was just wondering if. Getting into the sort of mindset of people, the oligarchs, as they're correctly called in Russia in the 1990s, and what they were dealing with, did it help you rethink this moment of history itself?
Absolutely.
That's what I was asking.
Because honestly, as Americans, we look at things going on in any foreign country, and we have, unless we thoroughly engage and do our research and really investigate what is going on, we have a very distant view of what was going on. To me, one of the fascinating things has been, I was alerted to a documentary on the BBC, I think it was, called Trauma Zone. It's a 7-part series that is a documentary about what it was like to experience the fall of communism in Russia all across the entire country, and what it was like for them to try to get involved in their new capitalism. And it shows you, apparently, the filmmaker, forgive me, the name escapes me, but it's a fascinating documentary, and I'd highly recommend it to anybody interested in that time period. You see little excerpts of people's lives from all across the entire crazy, 11 time zones country of Russia. In the backwoods, in the big cities, in the medium cities, and you see little excerpts of what their lives were like while these things were going on. And it really provided a wonderful context for seeing how crazy everything seemed to be, how desolate in some cases, or how uninformed the general citizenry in Russia was at the time and didn't necessarily understand what it would mean to be a part of this new way of living and what it was they might have been losing at the same time. People like Boris, who were wickedly smart, and understood exactly what was going on, took advantage of it very, very quickly. Whereas most of the country just thought, okay, no, maybe this means we'll make some more money, or, you know, they had been really taken care of under communism somewhat, to a degree. At least they relied entirely on the system, so to speak. And when that disappeared, it was a free-for-all. So that was something I was not, that had not been terribly clear to me, how chaotic that time was in that country, and what it must have been like to be there. We capture it in moments in our play, that sort of crazy surge of opportunism at the beginning of all of that, and you sort of follow where that leads our characters.
I think it might make sense to talk about the title of the play. Do you read it as ironic? It's both. Do you read it as serious, or do you read it as having a dual meaning? And Boris himself obviously has a very interesting career, to say the least. And one of the points that is made in the play repeatedly is that he loves Russia. He doesn't want to leave Russia. The exile was almost worse than the death. And I'm just curious, how did you approach that issue of love for the mother country, and whether it was genuine or not? And this might be a bit out of left field, but, you know, my ancestors go back to Russia. I imagine yours might as well. So that's also something interesting in this sort of late 20th and 21st century, sort of viewing this as not Russian exiles, but Russian emigres and the home country. So patriots and someone whose family might have hailed from there. I'm curious.
Sure. Think. Well, yes. I think several of these characters in the play think of themselves as patriots, although their points of view differ tremendously. There was a line that was in the play that since is no longer in it, and it was something to the effect of Boris having written a letter to Putin and explaining that, you know, there are many things that separate us, but the intensity of our patriotism is identical. So that in some ways has some tremendous resonance for me in terms of looking at our own country these days, is that everyone in our country perhaps has their own perspectives of how the country should be. And to try to see what those, you know, a patriot can mean one thing to one person and one thing to another person. So perhaps there's some irony there, but I honestly think of it as more a collective term for all these individuals who were struggling with their own situations and trying to make a better world, not just for themselves, but who had, just as you mentioned, a tremendous love of this country, which was quite complicated. And as one of the characters also says in the play, you know, something to the effect of, you know, what does he say? The professor has a beautiful sentiment about, besides saying something, you know, Russia had spent so much time as an empire, it doesn't know what it is as a country, as well as the idea that the equation or the problem that is the Russian commonality or nationality is an equation that will never be solved in terms of its unification, in terms of its differences, in some ways it's very much like our own country, you know, having 50 different states and 50 different identities from just depending upon where it is you come from in the geographical location. You know, for them, it's, you know, the difference between, you know, living in the frozen tundra or living in a metropolitan city. It's the same with our country. How do you unify so many millions and millions of people? What is a national identity? And there is a substantial representation in literature about love of Mother Russia in many things that I've read over the years, and, you know, how people profoundly love it and miss it when they're gone. I guess it would be the same for anyone who really loves their homeland. And it's what they know. It's how they were raised. It's how they were reared. It's their part of their identity. The idea that Boris, you know, is to save his own life, goes abroad and tries desperately over the next 13 some odd years to get back home again and to try to, you know, launch a campaign against Putin. And as it turns out, he creates a kind of different identity as an activist while he's abroad as well, never losing that identity and love of mother country. And it's discussed a lot through the course of the show in many ways. And I can't help but think that it would have some resonance for what it would be like for an American to have to go abroad for a certain amount of time and not to be able to come home for whatever reason.
You started to allude to this in your last answer there, but as you were researching the role and preparing for this, for the performance, did you find a lot of resonance between what's portrayed here and what you see all around us in the United States right now in terms of the political conflict, in terms of the divides that exist, in terms of, you know, did it give you any insight into the general chaos, really? Because there's a lot of systematic breakdown happening right now in this country that I think would have echoes in Russia in the 90s. What did you kind of take away from that in terms of our current situation?
As you alluded to just now, the differentiation between the haves and the have-nots is, you know, is one of those things that certainly in the figure of Boris, as someone who was, you know, part of the citizenry there, you know, for 25 some odd years, was content being a scientist and a mathematician, a teacher, professor. And then suddenly found the wherewithal to put his ideas and thoughts into practice and then makes this huge amount of money. So he becomes one of these unique figures in the oligarchs who have these huge amounts of money and as a result of that end up having influence in the Yeltsin administration. It would be a completely different country, as would ours, if money had nothing to do with elections. But there are many similarities in terms of those kinds of things and how countries are run and how it seems money is necessary and that the more you have, the more influence you have. There are a lot of similarities in terms of what that time was like. And how you can, in some ways, understand, you know, the shift and the arising of someone like Putin, who had apparently, from the outside at least, portrays a great distaste for such things. But apparently, if you dig deeper, you can also understand that apparently he's made a lot of money doing what it is he does too. And plus, he's been their solitary leader for the last 20 some odd years. So there are many parallels to answer your question. And I think that's part of the fun of listening to the play is that even though it takes place in Russia, it's spoken mostly in a British dialect, occasional tinges of Russian or foreign inflection, but hopefully people will find the humor and all of the resonances in our current situation as well, particularly in regard to elections too.
I hear there's an election coming up. One of the things I just wanted to add to that's very interesting about the play is that it's almost this post-hypernormalization moment. Michael, I don't know if you've ever heard that phrase, hypernormalization, but it's something that scholars use to talk about the Soviet Union in the 1980s, where everyone kind of understands that nothing's working, but you have to like pretend it's normal. That to me feels a lot like the contemporary United States. So in some sense, the play is almost looking at what might potentially come next if we don't actually solve this problem of hypernormalization. And there is some chaotic transition.
Yes, absolutely. Great term. Yes, it it seems like we're all either, well, I guess it depends who you speak to, but hoping that we can find a commonality between the huge divide in our country. And in some ways, it's been fascinating to understand those things in a deeper way over the last 8 years or more about how our country flips back and forth, usually between, depending upon who happens to be in the White House, depending upon, you know, who gets a lot of attention and then who gets neglected for the next 8 years. And then it most often flips back to the other side and who gets the attention and who gets neglected. I can't imagine trying to run a country this large. I got to participate in a film about Abraham Lincoln a number of years ago that was taken from Doris Kearns Goodwin's book, Team of Rivals. And what resonates in my mind about that was how Lincoln was able to people his administration with exactly that, people who had such differing points of view that were just as valid. And he surrounded himself with all of these and tried to provide a balance for all the differences. And I think until we can understand that there are going to be differences, but can actually function and have a functioning government, we're not going to be able to get anything done.
American Prestige is brought to you in partnership with The Nation magazine. Please consider becoming a subscriber at americanprestigepod.com/subscribe. As a subscriber, you'll get access to dozens of exclusive bonus episodes, including breaking news specials, deep dives into regional histories, analysis of movies and video games, and much more. And if you subscribe at the founders level, you'll be able to claim a year digital subscription to The Nation. Thank you for listening, and now back to the show.
Michael, today, and for all you listeners, an essay was published on Curb Your Enthusiasm and how Larry David is the last of a certain type of Jew. So everyone check that out if you haven't. But Michael, I think it goes without saying you've played some all-time Jews from Arnold Rothstein to, of course, Larry Gopnik, which I just have to say for millennial Jewish men is like an archetypal figure. And of course, Navorosky was himself Jewish, and right. It's gestured to at the play very briefly, but I think very importantly. So I was just wondering how, since you have happened to play so many Jewish characters, and I think portrayed Jewish masculinity in a lot of different contexts, how did playing Boris relate to your previous experiences? And this might be sort of a summative question, but what have you discovered by playing so many different 20th century Jewish men in so many different contexts and in a century that the Berkeley historian Yuri Slezkin once referred to as the Jewish century?
Each perspective unique, each individual struggled with their own histories and where they came from. Anti-Semitism, whether they let it affect them, whether it infused their lives at all. These are all elements of things that seems to pepper and run through people's lives of these characters that I've played. It's a trip to walk in their shoes for a while from a physics professor in 1967 Minneapolis to Boris Berezovsky, who was born and raised in a country that had rules in place about Jews were not allowed to hold political office and all, anti-Semitism was a regularity, and there's histories of decimation of the Jewish people throughout that country and people struggling to just understand their own identities both as Russians, but also as, free people. And then you have someone like Dr. Richard Sackler, who who had this, you know, tradition of a very, you know, a thriving family, and, you know, was extremely well off, but also at the same time needed, I think, from what I've been able to understand about him, to establish his own brilliance and his own path, which is a general path for all individuals of any ilk. Paul Marshall, who I mentioned earlier, is also, you know, was a Jew in terms of his journey and how that peppered what it was that that he experienced as a lawyer in the music industry. It's been fascinating to learn about what life has been like, how much Judaism has dictated their identity, or how much they chose to shun it completely. You know, Rothstein's father was a renowned, you know, mensch in New York in his neighborhood, and gave freely to everybody, as did the Sacklers' father. He was apparently this very sweet man who anyone who ever asked him for anything, you know, he gave freely. And as a result, they had no money growing up. So the kids, all of a sudden, money became this huge thing for them. And they used whatever genetic abilities they had to study and to get themselves out of the poverty they were in. And as a result, they did what they did. It's interesting how that element of identity makes different men question things differently. Larry Gopnik in A Serious Man goes directly to the rabbi and starts asking questions about, you know, the situation that he is in. He seeks out the source of his Jewish identity directly, and it's very much a part of his suburban identity to participate in the rituals, and we get to see some of that as well. As Americans, it's fascinating because I read somewhere, or someone mentioned to me, that Jews only represent, you know, less than 2% of the population here. But I think as what may be considered a minority, they have a tremendous work ethic in general, having had to struggle for so long and having had so many rules in place against them having a significant homeland or any kind of a national identity.
And to me, particularly in many of the characters you played, there's this liminal insider-outsider status, where people who are the ultimate insiders, like a Sackler or even a Rothstein to some degree, right, Nevertheless feel like outsiders. And I think that really comes through in Boris as well.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah,
he's the oligarch, you know, and a lot of them are Jewish as well. Not all of them, of course, but a number of them. And they occupy this incredibly big position. But, you know, at the end of the day, as the play makes very clear, it's like they're still Jews. You know, and so, like, that to me is very indicative of the role that Jews have played in sort of secular modernity, occupying this ultimate insider but ultimate outsider status. And I think that comes through. And you know, maybe I'm an academic and I like seeing patterns. And a lot of the characters that you yourself have played, you know, scientists, yes, gangsters, very powerful businessmen, but they still share a sense of unease with their position, no matter where they are. And that really is the state of the Jewish man in the 20th century to a significant degree.
Yeah, I agree with you. And it's kind of funny that this character is kind of a confluence of all of those things. He is a scientist. He is a businessman. He becomes an activist and a politician. It's kind of running the gamut of little things that I've had the experience of having, you know, worked on in very separate projects and very different projects, and to have them all inside one life has been kind of fascinating to try to feel it all at once. There are moments when he is all those things, and his identity, depending upon who it is you speak to, shifts just as much. Some people see him as one thing and some as something very different. So it's been a complicated and fascinating research period. And I'm still learning about who the man is. I'm still learning about the play that we're telling. And we're still receiving rewrites. And Peter Morgan, the playwright, has been fascinated with Boris. I think there's something about him that has just really resonated in some ways, which is fascinating. I'd love to hear him speak personally a bit more about why he leapt from The Crown and from that entire series that he created on Netflix to this story is a fascinating jump to me.
Getting back to Boris, actually, and this is one of the things that I find most interesting in his, you know, in terms of an episode in his life, comes toward the end, and you mentioned it earlier. After living through sort of the break, his break with Putin and the establishment, having to go into exile and live basically in fear, watching, you know, Alexander Litvinenko get poisoned. I mean, you know, watching people that he knew and was close to killed by this government. All of those things, all of that happens. And then at the end, toward the end of his life, he writes this letter to Putin where he, you know, talks, as you said, you know, talks about patriotism and, you know, it could be portrayed essentially as an apology or as an, you know, asking Putin to forgive him for what he's done. I think even his girlfriend at the time said that to him, or she claims to have said that to him, that, like, you're going to send this and they're going to publish it and say, look, he's, you know, groveling and it's going to undo everything that you've done. And yet he did it anyway. And I'm curious, as you're occupying Berezovsky's headspace or trying to sort of understand what's going on there, what do you make of that particular episode?
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because as we are in previews right now, they have the freedom to take things in and take things out. At the moment, that letter, which was a large part of the journey, now has been removed presently from our particular telling of the story. What it provided was one thing, which was an apology, a request. An apology, it's a letter he wrote directly to Putin where he initially apologizes for having misjudged him, basically, entirely, and not having accepted him on his own merits and taking too much responsibility as having been the man who found Putin initially. He also includes a request to go home to Russia and then a pledge he makes to never get involved with politics again. And yes, in some fashions, depending upon how it's delivered, could be taken as groveling, could be taken as a lot of things. But I think for a man whose heart has always been with his country, with Russia, as a patriot, that I'd like to believe that he just sort of reached a place in his life where he did everything he possibly could to fight for what he believed in. And I think he finally got to a place where at the end of the letter, he says he just wants to live a quiet life, a quiet academic life back home and never get involved with anything again. And it's dramatized in the play in one sense or another. But as I mentioned in our current version, that whole part of the story has been removed to show a different trajectory. In the playing of it, when I had done it before, it made me feel a number of things, all of the things he's asking for, but it seems legitimate. And I guess in the end, it would depend upon it being each individual's subjective point of view about someone who has basically been, you know, ground down to a place of basically asking, you know, or kindness and saying, look, I only did what I thought was right, but I would be grateful if you'd let me come home. And I promise you, I will never get involved with any of this again. You can go on and I will even support you and your administration. That's where the idea of homeland comes in and what it might feel like to have to live a life away from what it is that you know and love. I know a lot of folks felt this country, our country, under the previous administration, was in a place where they didn't want to be a part of it. And so they left for a while. And I can understand how, if things are terrible at home, you'd want to go to a place where you can function and think clearly and not be in any danger in order to have a life with some gravity and meaning and peace, which everyone should have. And if you can't have it in your home country, then you should find it somewhere where you can. But I think ideally everyone would love to be able to do that in the place that they call home. And it was something that there's evidence of in terms of Boris's particular journey in this story.
Michael, thank you so much. Just a final question. I was sanctioned personally by Russia 2 weeks ago. That is true. Can you help me overturn it? Can you get me in contact with Putin?
He's yeah, asking no, I really
was.
Anybody.
It was the wildest answer. Thing,
any,
man.
Any like, other guess?
Like for, I have no idea, but they personally sanctioned me along with like Larry Summers and head of like Northrop Grumman.
Wow.
But no, I'm just kidding about that. I just wanted to say thank you so much for taking the time. I want everyone to seriously consider seeing the play. It's really nice. And it, I think our listeners who are very interested in sort of this moment in Russian history, post-Soviet history, will find a lot. We'll truly get a lot out of it. So, Michael, and I also want to thank you for playing so many awesome characters that I've loved throughout my life. And thank you so much for joining us.
Of course, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.